Welcome to Out of Bounds. I'm Tish Perlman. My guest is Delphine Hiroshuna. Hiroshuna is a third-generation Japanese-American and co-author of several books, including Long May She Wave and Flavors of Japan Cookbook. Hiroshuna made an important contribution to the literature on the World War II experience of Japanese-Americans with her 2005 book, The Art of Gaman, Arts and Crafts from the Japanese-American Internment Camps, 1942 to 1946. This book resulted in an exhibit and is currently on display at the Smithsonian American Art Museum Renwick Gallery in Washington, D.C. The exhibit runs through January 30, 2011. Hiroshuna is also editor of the acclaimed magazine At Issue, Journal of Business and Design. I'm speaking to Delphine Hiroshuna by phone from her office in San Francisco. Delphine Hiroshuna, thank you so much for joining us.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
Now, The Art of Gaman is about the amazing and beautiful art that was created by many Japanese Americans who were incarcerated in internment camps during World War II. To tell us a little bit about the history of these camps.
Well, the camps involved basically any ethnic Japanese living on the West Coast. So when Pearl Harbor hit, the government was basically afraid of attacks on the Pacific Coast. And so, but the move to what they call evacuate the ethnic Japanese was partially tinged by special interest groups, sort of racial things, all kinds of other issues were involved. When they decided to evacuate the entire West Coast, that involved anyone with 1/16th Japanese blood.
That's amazing.
Isn't it? And the move was so thorough that they chose to take babies out of orphanages. The youngest orphan who went into camp was 3 months old. They emptied out hospitals, and so it was a very thorough cleansing. But the evacuation started in the spring of 1942, and because it was happening so hastily, that they it was decided to put the internees or the Japanese into assembly points. So in San Francisco, there was a Tamforan racetrack, and in L.A., there was the Santa Anita racetrack. And so initially, people were given a week's notice to evacuate their homes and settle their businesses and report into these assembly points, and they were assigned to live in horse stalls while the permanent camps were being built. And it took between 4 to 6 months to build the permanent camps. The permanent camps were located inland, so 8 of the 10 camps were in the desert, and mostly army government surplus land. Mm-hmm. Two of them were in swamped areas in Arkansas, and then basically they stayed open for 3.5 to 4 years.
Now, I understand from reading some of your literature that some of these camps were even put on Indian reservations. Talk to us a little bit about that.
It's the two camps that were in Arizona, the Gila River and Poston, were both on Indian reservations. And so, as somebody said, it was like a box in a box, because she said the Indians who lived on the reservation would come to the fence and stare in on the Japanese who were, in a tighter area. But they because they needed open land away from people, the Indian reservation seemed like a good place. So Poston was, it had about 18,000 people, and Gila had about 10.
Wow. God, when you think about this, it's beyond belief that this is part of American history. Now, your family was also part of this internment. To tell us about your parents. Your older brother was taken as well?
Yeah, my older brother was too. My mom apparently was pregnant when she went into camp. They were living in Fresno at the time, Fresno, California. And Dad was a farmer, and they were sent to Arkansas. First, they were sent to Jerome, Arkansas, and both of these camps were in southeastern Arkansas. Then, because there was such a labor shortage in the U.S., because, the men had gone off to fight, and the government was encouraging some people to take these jobs. They would be sponsored out of the camp. My dad spent part of the time working, harvesting, I think, the sugar beet crop or something somewhere. I can't remember exactly where he said, but I thought it was Michigan. And then he was drafted from the camps to go. So he served in the All-Nisei 442nd combat team, and so he served in Italy. And my mom and my sister was born in camp.
I just think that's so remarkable that while these people were being imprisoned in these camps, they were also expected to go fight for the U.S.
And a lot of people volunteered. Apparently a lot of the second generation or the Americans... if I could back up a little.
Mm-hmm.
At the time of the evacuation, in the entire U.S., there were 127,000 ethnic Japanese living in the 48 states. Of the 127,000, 120,000 lived on the West Coast. And of the people who were put in camp, two-thirds were American citizens. So... like my dad, he was born in 1906. He was born in Hawaii. He did not speak Japanese. He didn't read Japanese or write Japanese. And that was often the case because these were American citizens. And so many of these people had never been to Japan.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
The other part that people should know is the average age was 17 in camp.
Yeah, you mentioned that in some of your literature. It's just amazing to think about this as part of our history, isn't it?
Yeah.
Oh, my. Tell us how you discovered all these beautiful arts and crafts that finally became this beautiful book and exhibit.
Well, in 2000, my mom had died, and I just happened to be going through a box in the garage, and I ran across this bird pin, which is in my book, and I looked at it, and it had a safety pin clasp on the back. And just from the looks of it, what else was in that little box? Because when I looked at the box, there were trinkets from Italy, so it was obvious that my dad must have picked it up when he was serving in Italy. And then there were shell pins. There was this bird pin, and I figured it had to come from the World War II era. But I liked the bird pin, so I started wearing it. And one day, the man who designed my book, Kit Heinrich, saw it, and he said, you know, he asked me where it came from, and I said it was done, I think it was done in camp. And he said, I wonder what else was done in camp. It might make a good book.
Mm.
That's basically how it started. I thought, well, you know, I'll ask around. So I asked around, and most of the people, everybody seemed to have something, but they didn't ever. It was in storage. It was thrown in their garage. It was thrown in their shed. So when I started asking, and people would, if they found anything, they were handing it over to me in boxes that were still from 1945.
Wow. So they had never looked at it.
No. And newspapers, and I'd unwrap it, and the newspaper would be dated 1945. And a lot of people, because these things were made by... they weren't made by professional artists. They didn't value what they did. They saw it as a way to keep busy in camp or a way to make the things that they needed. And so when they gave it to me, oftentimes initially, not anymore, they said, you know, if you don't think this is good enough for your book, just throw it away.
Wow.
So I didn't throw it away, of course.
Yes, thank heavens you didn't. Tell us what the word gaman means.
Gaman means to bear the seemingly unbearable with patience and dignity. I think the Brits would call it grin and bear it, stiff upper lip. But basically, in a bad situation, you know, you don't complain. You just make the best of it. And so... And when I started picking up these items, and I would talk to the lender, and because all of the items in the show, or in this show at the Smithsonian, and in my book, they were borrowed from people. And the lender would often say, what could we do? We just had to come on. This was our way to come on. And so when I started searching for a name for the book, I proposed a variety of names, none of which seemed to work. And when I started thinking about the one word that everybody said, every single lender, they kept talking about this was the way to come on. And so, you know, ultimately that became the name of the book, The Art of Come On.
It's a beautiful word.
Yeah.
It is a beautiful word. Mm-hmm. Now there's a lot of silence about this camp legacy and this camp experience. You talk about how your family never discussed it, people didn't discuss it. Now was it difficult to get people to give you these items? Did it bring up memories for them and have them also start talking about the experience?
I think after the book came out, people started opening up. Initially, I think the fact that I did it in 2000, this century, made it easier for most of the people to lend it. I have thought that if I had tried to do this book, if I had tried to collect these things 30 years ago, I probably would have met with a lot of resistance. As it is, there was one man, when I asked him if he had anything that his family made, he told me to just leave it alone. He said, don't go there, leave it alone. And then he was so adamant about it, he called me again and he said, for your own sake, don't go there. So I think there was a fear that if they, you know, of raising the subject again, and but the fact that the people who, largely, with the exception of a couple of the artists, everyone else is gone. This was a first generation activity, and so it was their children who lent it to me, and I think they saw this as a way to honor their parents, and 50 years had gone by at that point, so it was easier for them to talk about it.
Mm-hmm.
But even then, I was getting some resistance from some people who felt that I shouldn't raise the subject at all.
That's interesting to me. I would think, you know, the old saying, we have to learn about history in order not to repeat it, would resonate.
I think it's interesting. I think since the book came out, at least my experience from some of these lenders is that they're seeing that what was made was really quite beautiful, and it honors their parents and puts a human face on them. And so there's a new pride about it that wasn't there before. I think before they saw it as just a reminder of a real grim period in their lives. And now they see it as a way to honor their parents, if nothing else. And as a sign that they were I feel that too often it's easy to say, throw around numbers. You could say 120,000 people in camp, you know, and give all these statistics. But to see one teapot or see one, you know, carved cow or some of the things that these people made, and then you start wondering about the individual, you start marveling at their talent and their sensitivity, and I think it puts a human face on them that hasn't been there before.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Delphine Hiroshuna. We're talking about her book, The Art of Gaman, Arts and Crafts from the Japanese Internment Camps, 1942 to 1946. Now Delphine, can you describe some more of the arts and craft pieces that you discovered? I know you talked about the little wooden birds. Well, what else did you find?
There were two camps that were located over ancient seabeds, the Tule Lake in California. It's in close to the Oregon border. And Topaz in Utah, that's over the Bonneville Flats. And they made most of the shell pin objects. So because when they got there, they discovered that it was a treeless, desolate area. But if you just scratch the surface of the ground, there were just millions of shells littering the ground. And somebody discovered that if you pick them up and you bleach them and you sort them, you can make beautiful shell pins. You can make beautiful table ornaments. And so that became a pastime in two of the camps. Now, when I started gathering things and seeing what was done, it seemed like the more beautiful wood-carved things came out of Arkansas, which was in a forested area. On the Indian reservations in Poston and Gila, there was the mesquite. After a while, I started getting familiar with what kinds of materials were indigenous to a region, and then I could start identifying where they came from even before I they told me where it was made.
Mm-hmm.
So it's, by and large, everything in the book and in the show were made from either scrap or found objects. And this is what is really remarkable, because there's a wonderful slate teapot made in Topaz, Utah. And this man was a gardener in Oakland. And this piece is just amazingly intricate and beautiful. And when you see the raw material that he started from and you know, what he came out with, it just, it really blows you away.
Yeah.
And most of the artists represented in this book were not professional artists. They were fishermen and shopkeepers and gardeners and farmers. And then to look at it and realize what they created, it really causes you to wonder about, you know, whether the artist lives in all of us.
Mm-hmm.
You know, to see this, because some of them are, you know, are really real serious works of art.
Oh, they are. They're remarkable. I was absolutely amazed by it. Can you tell us, I mean, the teapots and some of the furniture that was made make sense that they were using that while living in the camp. Well, what about some of the pins and the birds? Were they giving them to each other or giving them as gifts?
Certainly the flower pins. My understanding is the way the shell pins got started was because whole families were sent into camp and they were there for, you know, three and a half, 4 years, the life went on. These were not like the Nazi death camps. They were housed behind barbed wire with guards, you know, pointing guns down at them. But basically within that 1 mile area, there was a community going on. So they had Girl Scouts and Boy Scouts, and people got married, people died. You know, for those occasions, they were looking for ways, since flowers didn't grow well in the desert, somebody discovered that if you could make corsages by assembling shells into floral pins. And
mm-hmm.
And so some of these things just emerged out of necessity. But after a while, since they were there for a long time, it became a hobby.
Hmm. Now, you were talking just a few minutes ago. How many of these people, did any of them go on and become artists, or did they all give it up afterwards?
Now, I would say most of them gave it up. Because they didn't see themselves, because people were stuck in camp, if somebody had a skill, they would ask somebody else, their neighbors would ask them to teach them how they did it. And so everybody was carving. Everybody was making shell pins, or, you know, a lot of people were.
Mm-hmm.
So they did not see what they did as exceptional art. So when they got out of camp, because they had to make a living, times were really tough, most of them didn't go back to it. This was just for a brief period. And even the professional artists, when they got out of camp, I was reading about one person who had exhibited in salons in Europe before the war and ended up cleaning house for some people. I know that there's the artist who's the movie Cats America Tawny was based on, and he, you know, he didn't, he worked for, I think, as a driver for somebody. He was not able to pursue his profession the way he had imagined it.
That's a shame. This is more than just arts and crafts. This is real talent. A lot of the stuff depicted in this book and the exhibit. Now, these are now part of a display that traveled around and is now at the Smithsonian. Was it difficult for some of these artists to actually make all their lives essentially public? I mean, were they asked to speak? Did they have to become public when the art became public?
Well, since most of them were, but this is, no.
Mm-hmm.
The people who made these objects, with the exception of two that I'm aware of, they're gone.
Mm.
They died because this was a pastime not for the younger ones. This was the older, the Nisei, the first generation who couldn't leave the camps, and so they were basically in their 50s or older.
Hmm.
And so they're long gone. Their children, when the show opened at the Smithsonian, a few of their children came for the opening, but they're in their 90s. They're in their late 80s. And some of them did agree to be interviewed, but for the most part, I think that the nieces, the second generation, really see this as honoring their parents.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that their creativity and the resourcefulness of their parents.
Mm-hmm. And the beautiful things that they were
yeah.
able to make under these circumstances. Now Delphine, how did this research and involvement, which I assume encompassed several years, how did this affect you personally?
Well, like most people my age or my generation, Japanese Americans, I'm a Sansei, a third generation, my parents just didn't talk about it. So I didn't, other than knowing that they had been in camp and knowing that the camps were not a good place, I didn't really ask any questions and they didn't talk about it. So until I started working on the book, my knowledge was very superficial. And in order to write this book, I really had to sort of delve into the subject. And the more I got into it, the more disturbed I became. And also, by then, both of my parents were gone. And I couldn't talk to them about what their experience was or ask them why they didn't explain it to us,
mm-hmm.
and which made me very sad because, you know, now I have so many questions. And also, I think if they were around today, I'd probably apologize to them because there were certain trepidations they had, certain fears they had that just didn't make sense to me, and I would accuse them of being, well, timid. And now when I see what they went through, I'm more sympathetic to how they, what their reaction was to certain things. I mean, in the 90s, my parents went to the East Coast for a tour, and my mother called and she was afraid to go. She said, "People back east don't like Japanese.
Wow.
Do you think we'll be okay?" And I said, "You know, yeah, of course you'll be fine." But you know, this kind of fear lingered, and I think now, at the time, I just thought she was being silly. But the more I researched this, the more I could understand where that came from.
Mm-hmm.
And I was telling somebody about my dad. He was 96. He was 98 when he died a few years back, and they gave him some kind of pill because he had become septic and he started to hallucinate. And he wanted to know, we said, "We're going to come and take you home, Dad." And he said, "Where do we live?" And I said, "You know, on the farm." And he said, "Are there any white people nearby?" And we said, "Yeah, sure." And he said, "You know, white people don't like Japanese."
Wow.
And this came out of, you know, the whole war experience. And once we said, "Oh, you know who lives next door to us," he said, "Oh, okay, that's fine." But, you know, at that time, he was concerned that he was going to encounter some kind of prejudice.
Wow. And we certainly haven't eradicated racism in this country.
No.
In on the whole, for sure. Now, did your brother ever talk about it? Did he have any memories?
Well, my brother was two.
But was
when
he two?
He was in camp.
He was two, but did he end up leaving camp a little bit older? Or was
he was, I think, five when he left camp. So he, my sister was born in camp, so she really doesn't remember a thing.
Mm-hmm.
My brother doesn't talk about it at all, but he doesn't remember anything either.
Mm-hmm.
And the only thing the family talks about is the dog Bobby. And apparently when the camps were created, you couldn't take your pets into camp. And my brother, when the truck came to take them into camp, my brother started crying and screaming because Bobby kept running after the truck.
Oh, dear.
And so Bobby, the dog, was given to a neighbor, and the dog kept sitting on the side of the road hoping that they would return, and he was run over.
Oh, dear. What a story.
After that, my mother would never let us have a dog. And she would always say, well, it's too sad for the dog. And it's like, why is it sad for the dog? We treat the dog really well. I never understood it. But then when somebody finally told us the story about what happened to the family dog, then I could understand my mother's point about it's too sad for the dog.
Yeah. Now, was there ever an official apology from the U.S. government?
Yes, it came around, I think, in 1988. There was a congressional hearing, and they took testimony from some of the former internees, and there was a formal apology, and there was redress. The living internees got $20,000 in redress, and that happened, I think, around 1988. So my sister and brother did get a redress payment.
Mm-hmm. And by then, a lot of these people were already dead.
Yeah, unfortunately, I think a lot of the people who were adults and who really lost everything were gone at that point. So.
A sad story all around. Well, what do you want people to take from the book and the exhibit?
Well, certainly I'd like to raise awareness of this episode in history. So one is that I'd like them to know that the camps existed in the first place and the extent of it. But the other part of it is I really find that I'd like people to put human faces on people who were put in camp by looking at these beautiful objects and really considering the sensitivity and the skill of the people who made these things. And I'd like them also to think about that this isn't just a Japanese story. You know, since I worked on the book, I've heard of so many accounts by other ethnic groups that these things do happen, but somehow if we're not constantly vigilant, it could happen again.
Mm-hmm.
And the more, you know, when this book came out, friends have stepped forward and told me about their own stories, and they're heartbreaking. And so this is really hoping that people will think again, realize that we always stand on the brink of repeating such mistakes.
Mm-hmm.
And so this is just a reminder.
Yes, well, thank you so much for doing this. It's a beautiful book, and we do
thank
need
you.
to bring this from the fog of history back into our history books.
Thank you.
Now, Delphine, do you have any kind of a contact information that people can have if they want to get in touch?
Sure. They could either contact the Smithsonian, the Renwick Gallery, if they're interested in the artwork, or they could talk to 10 Speed Press, the publisher of the book, The Art of Gammon.
Okay, great. Well, Delphine Hiroshuna, thank you so much for joining us. And the book again is called The Art of Gammon, Arts and Crafts from the Japanese Internment Camps, 1942 to 1946. Delphine, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Our audio producer is Nate Richardson at Rep Studio in Ithaca, New York. If you'd like to make a tax-deductible donation in support of the Out of Bounds radio show, please contact our fiscal sponsor, the Arts of the Southern Finger Lakes, at earts.org. That's earts.org. Our theme music was composed by Diego Vega. And visit us online at outofboundsradioshow.com. We'll be back next week. I'm Tish Perlman.